It's been 18 hours since SEPTA's largest union went on strike, and plenty of commuters are still wondering how long it'll take them to get home. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. SEPTA buses, trolleys, and subways are idle today after members of Transport Workers Union Local 234 went out on strike at midnight. Regional rail trains are still running, although a group of picketing workers at one SEPTA facility blocked access for rail employees trying to get to their trains. That's according to SEPTA spokesperson Andrew Bush.
While it's still an ongoing situation, we have had to start canceling some service because the crews aren't available to operate some of those trains.
Bush says some of that service will be restored, and SEPTA is seeking a court injunction to get the picketers to move. All of this is creating more headaches at SEPTA's already busy Center City rail hubs. Standing by at Jefferson Station is WHYY's Peter Crimmins. Peter, what's the situation at this hour? So in addition to gasps, what comments are you hearing?
There's that sense of organization in the station. This man was frustrated that this happened at all. He has his grumblings with how this is going down. But what's happening at the station is organized. There's a team of ambassadors that was deployed by SEPTA. There are a bunch of people, dozens of people, wearing these fluorescent green vests. And they reach out to people who seem to be confused. They ask them where they're going, where they need to be. They tell them where to stand in line. They tell them where to get a ticket. And they guide you through the process of getting through the commute. Because I don't think anyone, at least the commuters, thought that it was going to be this much of a crush.
Are the ambassadors or anyone else offering some sense of what the morning commute might be like tomorrow?
No, people are sort of playing it by ear. They're trying to figure out alternative routes. One woman came into the station. She saw the thousands upon thousands of people. She immediately left the station, went back to the street to try to find an Uber pool, a carpool by Uber. She wanted to go to Roxborough. She realized it was $40 a head to get on an Uber pool. And so she turned around, went back into the station, and tried her luck with SEPTA because she wasn't willing to spend that much to get home to Roxborough.
WHYY's Peter Crimmins reporting from Jefferson Station. The evening commuting woes cap a day of frenzy as regular transit riders scramble to find ways to get around. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports on how day one of the strike went.
With buses, trolleys, the L and Broad Street subway shut down all over Philadelphia, people flocked to alternate means of transportation. Pamela Jones left early expecting problems and got into Center City an hour ahead of time. She says it's still an inconvenience.
I'm up an hour earlier. I had to park my car someplace where I'm not really sure it's going to be safe. Being that early, it's still dark out, it's just a little bad.
Viola Bivens says she remembers the last strike in 2009, which went on for 6 days.
When they had the other strike, I had to go through it. So, yeah, I'm used to it.
Bill Mularkey says the regional rail trains that are still running are a whole lot more crowded.
Usually when we come in, it might be about 20% full. It was totally full this morning by the time we got into town.
Dustin Albert was caught off guard by very slow traffic on the way to dropping his child off at Andrew Jackson Elementary in South Philadelphia.
Just dropping off the younger kid at preschool and then coming up Broad Street and trying to swing by to drop my first grader off, and traffic was just, jammed. So it took an extra 10 minutes, which got me past the 8:30 gate closing, which meant that we had to go in and stand in line to sign in. And I'm hoping that I don't have a parking ticket.
While in Philadelphia for an event, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf urged both sides to come together.
This is something that is just bad for everybody, and it has to end.
Mayor Jim Kenney says the strike is frustrating, but the city will not intervene in talks unless requested to do so.
We're urging them to continue to talk, continue to work on this, and we understand, that people are upset, and they should be, because it's very inconvenient, and we're doing our best to get it done.
Commuter Rose Peters, who's taking the regional rail train because of the strike, has a simpler message.
Hurry up and get it done, period.
I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The presidential campaign was back in the Delaware Valley today as Republican candidate Donald Trump and his running mate Mike Pence addressed a crowd of several hundred attendees in King of Prussia. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the focus was health care policy.
The Trump campaign hopes to capitalize on news of premium increases on plans available through the Affordable Care Act. So the nominee took a day off from talking about Hillary Clinton's emails. He stayed on message, saying if he's elected, he'll call a special session of Congress to repeal Obamacare.
And it will be such an honor for me, for you, and for everybody in this country, because Obamacare has to be replaced. And we will do it, and we will do it very, very quickly. It is a catastrophe.
Pence offered more detail on health policy, saying the ticket would implement market-based reforms, emphasizing personal health savings accounts and letting insurance companies compete nationwide instead of selling policies specific to each state.
And just the way the free market works, healthcare providers are going to be more responsive when they're answering to patients' needs. They're going to be a whole lot more responsive than they are to insurance companies and big government bureaucrats. Donald Trump and I will protect Americans with pre-existing conditions so that they're not charged more or denied coverage just because they've been sick.
The Trump campaign website doesn't have financial data on costs and benefits of his proposal, but Trump says it will bring much better health care at a much lower cost. Pence said the nation's ready for change.
It's time to end this government takeover of health care and start over with American solutions.
Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The state of New Jersey has rejected a fiscal recovery plan proposed by Atlantic City officials, and that leaves open the possibility of a complete state takeover of the financially struggling resort town. The decision comes after months of opposition from Republican Mayor Don Guardian and members of Atlantic City Council to a takeover plan hatched by Republican Governor Chris Christie, as well as Democrats in the legislature. Atlantic City has seen its tax base shrink by more than two-thirds since the beginning of the decade, thanks in part to the implosion of the city's gambling industry. Five of the city's 12 casinos have closed over the past 3 years, putting thousands out of work and creating one of the state's worst pockets of mortgage foreclosures. All this comes on the eve of the 40th anniversary of the passing of the referendum that paved the way for gambling in Atlantic City. And 1 week from today, voters will be asked to again approve gaming, this time in northern New Jersey. Let's look back and then ahead with Gwendolyn Harris, executive director of the Walter Rand Institute for Public Affairs at Rutgers Camden. Dr. Harris, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Let's first look back on what was promised.
There was an expectation that Atlantic City was going to turn into a boom town. And there were promises of development opportunities across the state as a result of the revenues from the casinos.
And indeed, there was a heyday where thousands of employees had jobs and many were good jobs.
When I look at the picture of what is the impact of any economic development strategy, I kind of break it down into three areas. One is, how does it impact on the property tax? Two, how does it impact upon development? And here I would speak about economic development that impacts own source revenue, but also development that impacts quality of life. And then three, so how are the people in the community faring as a result of whatever this new initiative was?
So let's take them in turn. Property tax.
The casinos probably provided about 50% of the property tax in Atlantic City. But when resorts opened, the city was already experiencing a structural deficit, i.e. its revenues were not meeting its anticipated expenditures and debt. Many of the casinos appealed their property tax bill and won. The property tax that is collected goes to both the school district as well as the municipality. When they won their appeal, the municipality ended up having to not just refund the part of the money that came to it, but also what went to the schools, which then exacerbated the structural debt.
Let's look then at another topic, development.
Development. When you look at an economic development strategy, what you want to do is see if you can get additional businesses to be built around that particular industry. Because not only are you talking about providing an economic focal point for people who come to the casinos, but for other people who may not come to the casinos but may come there to shop. The problem is that the development also helped to fund projects all over the state. Not to say that things were not invested in Atlantic City, but the net result at the end of the day is the casinos are the primary industry, and they continue to be the primary industry. It wasn't used as a catalyst to build toward there being some corresponding economic sectors within the city that could also generate own source revenue for the city.
Is it an oversimplification then to say that the Atlantic City residents were shortchanged?
One of the things that we look at is jobs. And you've got a significant portion of the population who have jobs in the casino industry. But one of the things that happens in many distressed cities all over the country, folks get a job, job is good and stable, and they move unless they can find good housing in a comfortable neighborhood and effective education. And so when you start to look at those kinds of things, you have to really question whether or not the development did as much as it could, particularly as you start to look at the quality of life issues.
Do you have a sense that there is now a sense of stability, though, in Atlantic City? It's lost, what, I believe, 5 casinos. Lots of jobs.
Yes, there's been critical downsizing. The closures of the casinos have really hit hard. The state is taking a very strong role in terms of wanting to help right the ship. But frankly, fixing a distressed city, and I'm not talking about fixing the casinos, I'm talking about fixing the distressed city, and I don't see them as one and the same, is about matching the people who are there with productive means of making a livable wage. And the casinos haven't been able to do that.
Dr. Harris, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
Gwendolyn Harris, Executive Director of the Walter Rand Institute for Public Affairs at Rutgers Camden. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead this evening, does being the brother of a congressman make you politically connected?
I don't know how much more of an outsider you can get than when you spend your career arresting corrupt politicians.
You could if your brother weren't the congressman. You would be more of an outsider that way.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health supports WHYY and invites listeners interested in improving population health in Philadelphia and around the globe to attend a graduate open house on November 12th. Attendees can learn about different degree options and career opportunities with a public health degree from Drexel's accredited School of Public Health. Learn more about Drexel's November 12th Public Health Open House at drexel.edu/public health open house.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Even if you don't live in Bucks County's 8th U.S. Congressional District, if you've spent any time near a TV recently, you've probably heard some negative ads directed at both of the candidates.
Brian Fitzpatrick wants to defund Planned Parenthood, just like Trump.
Career politician Steve Santacero has voted for higher taxes that destroy good-paying jobs.
That's because the 8th is the only competitive congressional race in our region and one of only a handful in the country. And national partisan groups are spending big money to try to win it. WHYY Pennsylvania suburban reporter Laura Benchoff is here to catch us up on the race and give us some context on Republican candidate Brian Fitzpatrick. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Dave.
So why is this race such a big deal?
There are a few reasons. First, the 8th District, which covers Bucks and a small portion of Montgomery County, has changed hands between Republicans and Democrats a few times in the last decade. And that just doesn't happen in very many places because of gerrymandering. So national interest groups are watching the race closely and spending a lot of money to try to influence who will be in the next Congress.
Who do the voters in the 8th have to choose from?
So now the seat is wide open. Republican incumbent Mike Fitzpatrick is retiring at the end of the year. In January, Mike's brother, Brian Fitzpatrick, announced he was running and quickly sewed up the Republican Party's endorsement, in spite of having no prior experience as an elected official and moving back to the district shortly before entering the race. Now Fitzpatrick's Democratic opponent, Steve Sinisiro, has attacked him for that sudden announcement and for his ties to the incumbent, including during a recent debate.
I've talked to many people in this community who feel that it's rigged, that there's one set of rules for most people and a different set of rules for people who are connected. I mean, Brian, the reality is you wouldn't be running for this seat if your brother were not the congressman.
Now, when I interviewed Brian, he insisted that this connection just doesn't matter.
I don't know how much more of an outsider you can get than when you spend your career arresting corrupt politicians.
You could if your brother weren't the congressman. You would be more of an outsider that way.
Well, I don't think that's really relevant. You know, Mike and I took very different paths in our life. He took the state and local government path. I've taken the national security path.
A side note, Brian's also been pretty shy of the press. It took months for us to get an interview with him, and the Inquirer reported this week that he's never granted them an interview.
So putting name recognition to the side, what is Brian Fitzpatrick running on?
So Brian is a former FBI agent, and he's running hardest on his national security and law enforcement experience. You know, he says his familiarity with those issues will really help him craft federal policy.
So for this non-politician, what form did that experience take?
So he graduated from the FBI Academy back in 2003 and was assigned to Manhattan. There he worked on some anti-corruption cases, including one called Operation City Lights. That targeted a New York assemblyman and labor leader. He also spent 3 or 4 months in Iraq around 2007 interviewing members of Al-Qaeda. And here in Philadelphia, he's prosecuted some drug cases.
Laura, we're focusing primarily on law and order, but voters typically tell pollsters that their number one concern is the economy.
That's definitely what we've been hearing in Bucks County as well. And Fitzpatrick, like a lot of Republicans in Congress, has railed against the national debt. His platform includes a couple of big policy changes that would really try to close down the amount of debt that the nation has been accruing year over year. And, you know, those proposals, you know, there are critics and there are proponents, and it's hard to say how they would impact the U.S. government.
Now give us a sense of where he stands on the many social issues.
So he represents somewhat of a moderate position. He says he supports same-sex marriage and protecting the environment. Although early in his campaign, he did say that he would vote to defund Planned Parenthood, but it's kind of tiptoed around that question ever since then.
Now, 1 week out, we have a pretty good sense of where the race stands.
We know that it's tight. Fitzpatrick had a lead at the beginning, and now that lead is essentially closed, say sources close to both campaigns. And that means interest groups on both sides are spending quite a bit of money to get their candidates in front of voters. When we talk tomorrow, I'll talk about how much money they're spending, and I'll also profile the Democratic candidate, Steve Sinisiro.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Dave.
Laura Benchoff is our reporter covering Bucks County. And for election coverage, check out our Decision 2016 website, newsworks.org/decision2016. Theater Horizon in Norristown is producing a musical about a songwriter who loses his ability to compose and is diagnosed with a condition that leads to brain surgery. The musical, called A New Brain, was written by a man who had the same affliction. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
William Finn's best-known works are the popular musical called The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee and a beautifully constructed show, Falsettos, which a few days ago began a Broadway revival produced by Lincoln Center. Between those two, he teamed up with James Lapine, who's Stephen Sondheim's major collaborator, to create A New Brain. It's the story of a young and totally blocked composer-lyricist named Gordon. Gordon writes, or would write more if he could, for a kids' TV program starring Mr. Bungie, a man who plays a frog. One day, when the show's producer is giving him a pep talk, Gordon falls flat on his face. He's rushed to a hospital and eventually diagnosed with arteriovenous malformation, snarled tangles of blood vessels that could cause his brain to hemorrhage. The musical is about how Gordon handles his condition and how everyone he knows handles him. Theater Horizon in Norristown is giving a new brain a great go. But no matter how much they try, no one can overcome the show's muddy tone and syrupy songs.
Stories of living, stories of dying, and ways we can deal with our fear.
That was one of the city's versatile actors, Steve Pasek. And he's what I'm talking about when I say the cast works hard to make a new brain work. They include Rachel Camp as Gordon's producer, Susan Riley Stevens as his mom, and Peter Carrier playing his boyfriend. Matthew Decker directs the show. He just won a local Barrymore for directing Stephen Sondheim's The Secret Garden at the Arden last year. William Finn wrote A New Brain in 1998 after grappling with the same condition that afflicts Gordon in this show. Was he too close to the material to sort it out theatrically? That's likely. It's unfair to expect a cast and creative team to do it for him. I suspect Theater Horizon comes as close as possible. A New Brain at Theater Horizon runs through November 6th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.